And would you like to make an opening statement?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to make an opening statement. I'll try to keep it brief. One of the greatest honors of my life has been the opportunity to serve as a regent of my university, the University of Minnesota that I attended and from which I graduated. I'm thankful and proud as well that both of my children were able to attend and graduate from the university. However, I'm very concerned about all those today who do not have the opportunity to pursue higher education. If we do not do a better job as a society of preparing our children to be college ready when they graduate from high school, and then to present them with accessible, affordable higher education opportunities, we will regress in our global competitiveness and our standard of living. Unfortunately, due to economic hard times, changing demographics, and competing demands on state and federal budgets, public support for higher education in the United States has been decreasing. In Minnesota, as a result of cuts in the state budget, tuition at the University of Minnesota has now surpassed state support for the university. As we look to the future, we will have to learn how to do more with less. I'm asking you to allow me to continue to serve the university and the state as we work through an uncertain future. My 6 years of experience on the board has given me a better insight into the complexities of the university and its culture, as well as some knowledge of what needs to be done as we move forward. I've served 6 years on the Finance and Operations Committee of the board. I've served 4 years on the Facilities Committee. Both of these committees will play a key role in leading the university through the new fiscal realities. The past 2 years, I've also had the opportunity to serve on the Audit Committee, which works to ensure that our resources are used properly. I've also served on the Educational Planning and Policy Committee and the Litigation Review Committee. My leadership skills have been recognized by the board leadership through my appointment as chair of the Finance Committee for 2 years and currently as chair of both the Facilities and Management Committee and chair of the Audit Committee. In my application to your committee, I've provided information on other governing boards and leadership positions through which I've gained experience and knowledge which have enabled me to do a better job as regent. As Secretary-Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, I am responsible for the handling of the finances of our organizations, and I understand the requirements of fiduciary responsibility and the need to be accountable to my constituents. As Secretary-Treasurer, I'm also involved in human resources management for our organization. I work with a diverse staff. 20% of our employees are African American. 70% of our employees are female. I'm responsible for negotiating labor agreements with two different bargaining units, and I currently am in the middle of rebidding our health insurance to secure significant savings while maintaining benefits. I also serve as the chief officer of our retirement committee overseeing the management of our defined benefit pension plan. The third focus of my job is public policy and involves working with the legislature to advocate on behalf of the 300,000 members of our affiliated unions. In preparing for this process, I once again reviewed the document outlining the roles and responsibilities of the Board of Regents and the individual regents, and I think these are very good statements of what should be expected, and I strongly agree with them. As a regent, I take them very seriously, and I would be glad to elaborate on any particular point should you wish that I do so. I'm passionate about higher education, and I love this university. I want to continue to serve as a regent to help the university through its current fiscal difficulties of preserving and enhancing the excellence of the education offered, the research conducted, and the public service delivered. We are blessed with a truly great university. If I'm fortunate enough to be reelected to the Board of Regents, I promise you that I will do my very best to serve the university and the people of Minnesota. When I leave the university, I want the university to still be a place that is able to serve people across the state through its extension programs and other public services. I want the university to continue to conduct the breakthrough research that has benefited our state with discoveries that lead to new discoveries and healthier lives. And I want to be a place where a kid like me from a working class family, whose parents never had the opportunity to go to college, can go to college, can receive an advanced education, and get the tools necessary to send them into life, prepared to succeed and contribute to society. Thank you. Now I'll breathe. Forgot to do that
before. All right, Paul Fowler.
Steve, I recall it 6 years ago when you sat in that chair. I asked you a question, and I couldn't find your answer notes on your answer. But my question to you was, if you were to be successful, as you were in pursuing the regenerative seat, by what metrics should we judge your service? And so why don't you try and recall what those metrics were, or what reasonable ones are, and relate that to your service?
To be quite honest with you, I cannot recall what they were 6 years ago. But I think if you look at any particular region, I think you would want to, first of all, determine that, yes, indeed, they did their homework. That's the most basic thing. Did they come to meetings prepared to partake in the meetings? Did they know the material well enough to ask intelligent questions? I would also think that a metric would be their judgment. Did they use good judgment making their decisions? Did they consider the data at hand? Did they consider the mission of the university in coming to their conclusions? Did they consider the comments of their fellow regents? I think that's a very important part. And I think another metric would be, how do you get along with the rest of the board? Are you a good board member? Are you a team member? Are you somebody who just goes along to get along? Or are you somebody whose concept of being a team member means that, well, you know, if I have a disagreement with you, I'm going to come talk to you about that disagreement and see if we can come to a middle ground. And maybe our middle ground is better than where either of us are camping right now. Or am I going to, you know, I think that's the right way to do it, but too often, especially I think you see it in Minnesota maybe more than other places, if I have a problem with you, Paul, I might go talk to Margaret about my problem with you instead of addressing you. I don't think that's a very productive way of doing business. So I think that's another metric, how you perform as a board member with the other board members. I think the other, I could probably keep listening, but the other most important thing I think you want to judge is, how does the regent separate the role of governing from managing? Mm-hmm. I don't think you would want to see a regent who is calling up the president, or worse, calling up people underneath the president, trying to tell them what to do on a day-to-day basis. Mm. I think it's very much the responsibility of the board to set down guidelines, to give advice when asked, but to step back and let your president do the job that they've been hired to do.
He's been hired to do.
Okay, all right.
Yes, Regent Hunter, I would like to have you look ahead to the next year, and this isn't a pie-in-the-sky question. It's what good thing would you like to see happen in the next 9 to 12 months, and I don't mean getting a rain of cash or something, but realistically, in your heart, as you see yourself going forward in the second term, what special thing would you like to see take place?
You know, you mentioned the rain of cash, and I'm well aware that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Given that, we are going to have to make some extremely difficult decisions in the next year, and we're going to have to do it at a time we are transitioning from President Brunix to President Kaler. I would think my goal would be that a year from now we could say we had a smooth transition And during that smooth transition, or perhaps as part of that smooth transition, we made progress towards right-sizing the university in terms of its programs, its administration, its staff, so that we're in a position to deal with the fiscal reality under which we live.
Yeah.
If we can do that in a coherent, transparent way that the public understands and supports, if we can do it in a way where we take the shared governance system of the university, take full advantage of that, that we don't try to dictate from the top down, but we listen to the faculty, we listen to the staff, we listen to the public. I think we can do it, and I think we can do it in a way that will leave the university stronger than it is today. So it's a huge challenge, but that would be my goal.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
First of all, I want to commend you for your attendance record at the committee meetings. This is pretty stellar. My question really initially, at least my first question, relates to what you didn't know 6 years ago and what you know now about serving as a regent. And you've given us a lot of great criteria for evaluating. But what were the surprises for you?
6 years ago, when I sat here and I talked about the university, I knew it was a huge, complex organization. I had no idea how huge and how complex. It took me a long time to, and I think maybe you never learn completely because I still find things I didn't know. But it was probably the first 2 years into my term before I felt comfortable on some issues, even talking to my fellow regents, because I knew there was so much that I did not know. It takes a long time, really, to figure out some of the way things work at the university. I think the other thing that astounded me, quite frankly, was the quality of some of our faculty and staff that are at the university. Once I had the chance to actually meet some of these people, I was just simply blown away by how bright some of our faculty are and some of the work that they are doing. The third thing that amazed me is I had read in the materials that were sent to us that you could estimate about 10 hours a week of time at the university. I was mentioning to one of the students outside the door, I said, maybe I'm a little slower at my work than some, but it takes me, I probably spend on the average well over 10 hours a week. Now, having said that, I think every minute of it is worth it. But I was astounded by the amount of reading and background materials that you are provided with, which is a good thing. But then again, it also increases the time it takes to prepare.
Thank you.
All right. Over here. No, Jerry Rogers.
Thank you. I also want to thank you for your service to our university. You mentioned in your opening statement that you, one of your functions is to meet with the legislature regarding your jobs with the AFL-CIO. And you also need to do that as a regent. Are there conflicts between those two organizations, or how do you deal with potential conflicts?
There are potential conflicts. I was mentioning when I came in, I was introducing Margaret Nost, I had my Alumni Association pin on. That's not the very simple things I do, but I've told many of legislators, I said, well, look, I have my AFL-CIO pin on today. This is an AFL-CIO position that I'm lobbying on. One of the places where we cross paths most frequently is one of the things I work on for our organization is capital bonding bill. It's critical to our building trade unions. They need work. The capital bonding bill provides jobs for construction workers. The university has a bonding package every year that they propose as well. Typically, there isn't a conflict because usually our organization endorses both the Minsky proposals and the university proposals that go into the capital bonding bills. But what I do very carefully, and I'm very careful to do this, is I would check with Donna Peterson, who's the lobbyist for the university, to make sure that any message I'm giving to the legislators is either aligned with the university's message, or if it's not, I know where it's not, and I can make it clear to the legislature, the AFL-CIO thinks this ought to happen. the university thinks this ought to happen. That rarely happens, but mostly it's communicating with the university staff and lobbyists and not trying to do their work for them. Typically, Margaret will ask me maybe once or twice a session if I could talk to a specific legislator on a specific issue that they may be having trouble with. But generally, that's how we address it is, you know, I'm usually doing my work, they're usually doing their work, and I help as necessary. But we don't have very many conflicts. If we did have a sharp conflict, I would just simply have to explain that, you know, I need to be on one side or the other. I am paid by my employer to represent the Minnesota AFL-CIO. I'm making it quite clear when I talk to the legislature, this is the Minnesota AFL-CIO's position, not the university's position. However, that has never happened in the 6 years I've been on the board.
Okay. All right, Richard.
In your tenure as a regent, what item or accomplishment that you personally had an impact on during the board you're kind of feel the best about, and conversely, what didn't get accomplished that you feel that you would like to get accomplished in the coming six-year term?
You know, I don't want to take credit for things that I didn't necessarily have. You know, the regents play a role in things, but because we're not there every day, it's the staff that should really get credit. But we have made, and we continue to make progress on the graduation rates. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of that. I'm very happy, and this is something that happened entirely on my term on the board, although the seeds were planted long before I got on the board, is the development of the Rochester campus of the University of Minnesota. When I first heard about that, I believe Governor Pelini proposed that at the time I was running for regent, I thought my initial reaction was, I'm not sure we should be putting all that money into another campus at a time when even then resources were getting scarce. But the way that campus has been done and the way that it's been done as a public-private partnership, and we've leveraged the resources of the city of Rochester to the benefits of both Rochester and the university and to the Mayo Clinic, I think that is an amazing accomplishment. I would point to that as one. I'm sorry, did you also ask?
Well, the last part of the question is what didn't get done that you wish could get done?
I wish we were further along the road in determining how we are going to deal with this fiscal crisis. The colleges have had blue ribbon panels. Some of them have made the reports back. Some of them haven't. But I wish we had more certainty. I think we're going to have to eliminate some programs, for example. I wish we had more clarity as to where that's going to happen. I think what we have to do is focus our resources on the things we do really well and the programs that are really successful. We have some programs in some departments where there doesn't seem to be that much market demand for them. We have some that I think could be done through other institutions, MNSCU perhaps, that maybe we don't need to be doing and we don't have that many students pursuing that maybe just need to go away. And I don't know if we're far enough down the road on those discussions. I think a lot of my colleagues feel that frustration. On the other hand, I do know that, you know, the president's trying to take a very deliberative approach and involve the faculty, and maybe we just have to sit with that frustration for now. But those are hard decisions that are going to have to be made, and they're probably going to have to be made in the next 12 to 18 months. And I would feel more comfortable if I had a better sense of where those decisions were going.
Okay. Sylvia Catalan, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You mentioned in your opening statement and also in your application the need to be careful about tuition increases in the future. And having served as a regent and fully understanding the role that you play within the board, what can you tell us about how you can help protect the students in the future when the university needs revenue and you look to adjusting tuition?
Well, I think one of the starting places, what I was just speaking about, is I think we need to better focus what the university is doing. I do think in some respects, and perhaps in the number of programs offered, for example, we need to become smaller so that the revenue that we are receiving can be focused on our stronger programs. Now, one of the things you also have to take into account, though, is if we're not offering these programs, maybe we won't have as many students paying tuition, and tuition could go down. However, I think student demand is high enough. We had well over 30,000 applications for about 5,000 vacancies. So, yes, we might not get this group of students who wanted to take this obscure little major, but I think we can backfill that with students who are interested in what we will still be offering. So I think we can reduce the number of programs, keep the number of students, which leaves more money for the remaining programs. I think we also have to work very hard on controlling our administrative costs. One of the things that intrigued me when I had the opportunity to meet with Dr. Kaler, who's our president-elect, is he talked about the difference between Stony Brook University and the University of Minnesota and what cost to educate a student, the educational cost. And I think he'll probably come in with some really good ideas on how we can streamline administration, streamline the whole process to save money there. We can't just look at the revenue side of the equation. I think we've stretched tuition. I know it's been hard. I think it's going to get even harder because we've been subsidizing tuition the last few years with federal stimulus money, and that's going to go away. And again, that gets to my point. We're going to have to make some very difficult decisions over the next 12 to 18 months in terms of what we cut. The other part of that is we have done a very good job, I feel, in terms of offering financial aid, particularly to students from families whose income is less than $100,000, and do that on a sliding scale type method. But the question there is, can we sustain that? And now I hear there's some discussion in Washington about the cuts to Pell programs as the Republicans try to balance a budget. Well, if that happens, I'm not sure we can raise money for financial aid as fast as the money that might be going away that's currently going to assist students. So I don't think there's a lot of room to say, well, all that taken into account, we still need to increase tuition 10%. We simply can't do that. And it's going to come down to some very painful cuts in some places, I'm afraid. And quite frankly, there's going to be some students who may not be happy with what we have to cut either, because it might be the program they like. But we can't sustain what we're doing, unfortunately. There's not going to be a rainfall of cash on the university.
Thank you.
David Fisher, please.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Regent Hunter, you're going to be possibly going from this body to the legislature. And legislators are going to be asking questions, of course, about the University of Minnesota and the financial issues that are coming up. They'll be doing that as the administration goes to argue for its budget. I'm sure one of the things they're going to be asking about is whether you have any specific ideas around the notion that you've raised concerning combining some functions in administration. You indicated reducing costs, and can you do that without laying off people? And also one question I've asked previous people, do you happen to know the per student cost of education at the University of Minnesota?
That is a number that varies depending who you talk about, but my understanding is that it's in the high teens to perhaps 20,000. And again, it depends. Yeah, some people factor in this, and this. Other people factor in this and this. So I can't give you a hard figure on that. To the other point, I don't think that we can get to where we need to be financially without reducing the workforce. Now, whether there are layoffs, that depends how many people leave for other reasons. We reached that point, as I'm sure everybody read, where I think every day now 10,000 more baby boomers reach the point where they can retire. Well, we're going to have some turnover in staff, both faculty and support staff. And I think we need to use that opportunity to carefully look, as we have been since the president instituted his flexible freeze, at every position, and does this position really need to be refilled? which duties in this position are absolutely critical to the university, which are duties that make it perhaps easier for some people to do some things, but they're not really necessary. Can this position be combined with another position? And we may need to look at entire units to see if we can do that. There's a constant shove and pull between centralization and decentralization at the university. It seems to me that most of your colleges all have their own public relations arm. I don't know if that's sustainable. But on the other hand, I know the counter-argument is, well, nobody knows the College of Liberal Arts like the people in the College of Liberal Arts. But we can't keep doing business as possible. I have seen some progress. I don't get nearly as many printed materials anymore. More and more colleges and departments are sending out their newsletters via email, things like that. That saves some printing costs. That saves some postage costs. That's marginalized. One of the things I think I need, and all of my colleagues need to resist, though, is getting to the point of saying, I think you do this and this and this specifically, and I'll save that much money, because that's management. I think what we need to say as a board, a governing board, is we don't think that administration should be more than X percent of our operating costs, and that's after we get a clear definition of what is part of that administrative pie. Now, typically, you know, we talk about administration, well, then you also are including things like utility costs. Utility costs are one of the big cost drivers at the university, and although our carbon footprint is smaller than it was in 1999, even though we have more assignable square feet, we currently have more square feet of space than we can sustain as a university. So one of the things the Facilities Committee is working specifically on is, what's the right size in terms of square feet for the university, and how do we get to that point? What space can we decommission, take offline totally, so we're not paying for heat, we're not paying for water, cooling, and eventually, hopefully, we can tear the building down and not even have to, you know, worry about keeping the building up to snuff. We have a estimated cost of about $160 million per year to maintain our property, but historically, we last 4 or 5 years, we've only spent $80 to $85 million doing that. If we can reduce, right-size our space, there's a significant savings there. And that, those kind of decisions, like what size should we be, are appropriate questions that come before the Board of Regents. I don't think necessarily the regent should step into line-by-line itemization of the budget. So I think we have to be at the larger area, and I think we have to support the president. I think President Brunix has had some good ideas. I'm quite sure Dr. Kaler is going to come in with some strong ideas of his own. He took the job knowing the situation we're facing. I'm sure he thinks about it every day. And we have to support the president in that. Thank you.
Okay, Margaret Carlson, please.
Well, I probably have had a close-up opportunity to see you work when I was CEO of the Alumni Association before I retired, and what on your attendance list doesn't show, probably other than only one regent that I can remember in the 25 years I worked at the U, attended more events for the total university than you have, teaching awards, mentoring, annual meetings, and the list goes on. That is quite a tribute because it's outside of the 40 hours plus. Now my question. You said that at times you have to find the middle ground better than we are where we are right now. What was the most contentious issue that you had to look at that took real courage? And at the end of the day, you might have been the only dissenting vote or one of two, looking back at your 6 years.
I think the one that I agonized the most about was the first situation I had, and it happened very shortly into my term. You know, I said it takes, I think my colleague who was here earlier probably mentioned this, so it takes a while to get to know the university. Well, I believe I was elected in March, and by June I had to vote on a major restructuring plan for the university. Hindsight being 2020, the president was right. The plan worked. I thought that most elements of the plan made a lot of sense, but I had a lot of unanswered questions. I had people in this building, advocates for the lumber industry, for example, who were very concerned about merging the College of Natural Resources into the College of Agriculture, who had a lot of questions which, quite frankly, I could not answer. We were all hearing, and I think most of the public noise about the restructuring was about the future of General College and General College going into the College of
Human
Education and Human Development. That's it, College Education, Human Development. And there were a lot of unanswered questions on that. And quite frankly, my colleagues had a lot of unanswered questions. And I ended up voting no. It was not an easy vote. I agonized over it, quite frankly. I spent sleepless nights over it, and I rarely have sleepless nights. Because I thought, in my heart, I thought it was the right direction to go, but I also had problems with the process. I thought these questions should have been answered before we voted. Mm-hmm. Now, looking at the history of when these things had been proposed earlier, not all of them as a package, but pieces, I understand why the president wanted the vote when he called for the vote, because he had the votes to pass it, and historically they just got picked at, and those kind of bold proposals would fail. But I did have a lot of concerns about how the whole system was going to work, and I had concerns about the process. Now, I'm very happy to say that my concerns were addressed. When those answers started coming 3 or 4 months later, things worked out well. When I met again with the representatives of the timber industry, they were very pleased with how the College of Natural Resources merged into the College of Agriculture, and they felt they were getting the attention they needed. We are still continuing to admit students who would have been what we would call the general college cohort, and those students are doing better. So, you know, despite my concerns about unanswered questions, those questions were later answered, and they were later answered in a very positive way. Another situation where we got to more of a middle ground, and that was more recent, is everybody knows that the university this year has had some furloughs, mandatory furloughs, and we shut the build campus down between the Christmas holidays. Well, originally that was proposed as everybody was going to take X amount of time off. And I had some concerns on a couple counts. One, I had a previous life experience when I was in another role, and I was leader of a local union in Minneapolis, and we were going through the then Alcui budget crises. And we had addressed a similar situation through voluntary furloughs. And the program was so successful, I had people who wanted to file grievances because they wanted more time off without pay than the city would grant them. And I would have liked to have seen the president offer something along those lines on a voluntary basis. I recognize you can't bank a voluntary basis, but what you can do is you can say, I think the initial discussion started about March of last year, by June 30th, we need to have firm commitments from everybody how much time they'd be willing to voluntarily take off. And then you look and you say, does that save enough money? If it does, that's great. These people have committed to taking the time. And part of that commitment would be you can't change your mind because we're going to deduct the pay in any case. And if it's not enough, well, then maybe the mandatory part of it is less for everybody else. Well, I didn't get the president to go that far, but I think not perhaps only because of my voice, but because of other voices the president heard. The program did find more of a middle ground to where people above a certain income level were expected to sacrifice more than people below that level. So I think that was an outcome where maybe the president wasn't as happy as he could have been. I wasn't as happy as I could have been. The university probably came out better because of the discussions that occurred.
Ardell Brady.
Regent, good to see you again. Your major area of study when you graduated was theater, So personally, was this first 6 years, has it been a comedy, a tragedy, a soap opera, or in the next six, can it be Wizard of Oz or what?
No, I hadn't thought of it. No. I think it's been a little of each. I mean, it's not all hard decisions. There are some fun times. There are some very rewarding times. Certainly, I would say that if you've studied Shakespeare, if you've studied Sophocles, you probably have a pretty good understanding of human nature. And a big part of this job is understanding human nature. I will tell you that there are times where I'd say it's Gilbert and Sullivan. The first time I got to participate in a graduation ceremony, and we have these huge, heavy robes we wear and the fancy hats, I kept thinking that I was Groucho Marx in horse feathers, and police officers would come out and point out that I only have a BA after my name, and everybody else on the stage has a whole alphabet after their name. And quite frankly, those are the really happiest occasions. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what the kids, not just kids, but adults go there too, is to get that degree and to be part of that celebration. Mm-hmm. Is a very meaningful experience for me. But there's also, you know, there's been some times where I've had to go to some of my constituents or go to other regions and just have some really hard discussions, and everything seems more important at the time that it happens, perhaps, than it does later on, and you realize that life goes on. But
okay. Paul Taylor, please.
Good, thanks.
A little of each.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Regent Hunter. I'm a 1961 liberal arts graduate from the University of Minnesota and have been very active as a volunteer, quite familiar with the CLA 2015 proposal. You made earlier reference to, you know, major collegiate units going through this process, and you talked about right-sizing. I'm curious, what role do you as an individual regent and the regents as a whole play in looking at substantive proposals of that nature?
We have not. We've received the report. We have not been asked to make any decisions at this time. At some point, I would anticipate that the president, whether it's President Brunix or President Taylor, will have to come forward with specific proposals on restructuring. The University Board of Regents has the responsibility to either approve any new program that's created or to approve any elimination of programs. So, you know, in terms of the Board of Regents and their defined duties, it's right there. But then more than just that yes or no vote on do we do it or do not, I think there's a responsibility to listen. Every program has constituencies. As I found out since I've been on the Facilities Committee, every building has constituencies. And so you have to be able to listen, and listen with an open mind. Many cases, there'll simply be an emotional attachment, but in other cases, there'll be things there that, you know, maybe we hadn't thought about this, and if we do close this department, where is this kind of education going to be delivered? Are there other institutions in the state or in the Midwest or in the country that offer a similar program? Is there a way that this, you know, if we decide we do have to preserve, is there a way we can do it that in a way that's affordable? But at the end of the day, there's going to have to be some very hard decisions made, and you're not going to be able to make all the constituents happy, but I do think you need to listen to them, and I think that's very critical. They want to feel that they were listened to, even if you can't do what they would like you to do. I think one of the things about this budget crisis, it's gone on so long that everybody realizes it's there. I think at first there was a lot of denial. But to get right to your question, the main thing the regents have to do is once those come to the board, we have to evaluate whether we agree that that's a good idea or not, understanding that we all understand the fact that we do have to make some tough decisions. And before they can be approved, and we are the board that has to say, yes, it's gone, or no, it's going to stay.
Thank you.
Hi, Jennifer, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regent Hunter, how would you, right now, how would you express the strengths and the weaknesses in terms of the university's commitment to equity and diversity?
I think there are some strengths. I think if you look at the graduating classes, especially in the Twin Cities, if you look at the percentage of graduates of color, and then if you look at our freshman class, the percentage of minority students in our freshman classes is higher than what we are graduating from our high schools. I think we've made progress on diversifying our faculty. I think the weaknesses are, one of the weaknesses, glaring weaknesses, are the graduation rates. We've made progress in the graduation rates. However, the graduation rates for students of color is still significantly below that of Caucasian majority students. One of the another exciting thing about Dr. Kaler is Stony Brook is one of the few institutions in the United States where the students of color are actually doing better than the majority students. So I think he will come in with some very good ideas about that. I think the university can do a better job of sometimes being culturally sensitive in its communications to the public. Sometimes it seems to me that a lot of the communications are pretty much based on a majority understanding of the world or a majority view of the world. There's been some times where I thought, ooh, that could have been said a little bit differently, a little more sensitive way. But I think what most people would be concerned about, what most people are interested in, is seeing those graduation rates improve, particularly where that gap to narrow between students of color and the rest of students.
And one quick follow-up. It's kind of the challenge question in terms of this umbrella. I know you're familiar with the movement around the country for in-state tuition rates for undocumented children in the country, and these are children who've grown up here but don't have legal citizenship. I don't want you to put yourself in any place on the positioning, but how would you bring that up with the board? And obviously there's students, as we all know, even in Congress, who are standing next to their legislators waiting for a shift in the immigration policy.
First of all, let me say I'm one of those who believes our immigration system is seriously broken. In my role at the AFL-CIO, I have also met with representatives of the business community who complain the system is broken. And I don't think that it's fair for the children. The system isn't broken because of the kids who grew up here and their parents came here because they needed work. So I don't think it's fair to penalize them. In terms of the board, one of the things we have done for a number of our campuses, not the Twin Cities campus, but a number of our campuses, is we've simply eliminated that disparity between in-state and out-of-state tuition for everybody. I think as on the board level, I think typically the way it would probably proceed is it would start as a discussion in the Educational Planning and Policy Committee and then progress to the full board. Typically, discussions around tuition have started there. They might have a quick briefing in the Finance Committee, but really it is kind of a educational policy question. That being said, I'm not shy to tell you that I think the DREAM Act was a good act, and I wish it would have passed.
All right, Jim Erickson, please.
Regent Hunter, thank you very much for your many, many more hours spent every week than 10. On January 20th, the Regent Candidate Orientation Committee of this board is going to meet and invite all those who go forward to come to it, and we hope if you go forward, you will attend. Your present colleague, Rick Beeson, and former colleague, Maureen Reed, are going to speak from the Regent's perspective to brief them. You've been through that rodeo. If you were presenting that, what would you say to them? And let me turn it around a bit and say this. 9 of the 15 members of the House Higher Education Committee and 8 of the 14 members of the Senate Committee are new to that committee. And I'm wondering if you will, in your candidacy, if you go across the street, and you would encourage those others to turn the interview process around to bring the message of the, to the university, to these folks who need to know more about it. And you would be an advocate. They're interviewing you, and you have to spend your 5 or 10 or 15 minutes of glory with them. But how might you or they use that teachable moment for these particularly new members of these two important bodies?
For the first part of your question, my advice to anybody who's about to seek election after coming through this committee would be to clear your calendar as much as you can, spend as much time as you can up here. I've looked at those committee lists, too, and I realize there's a large number of people there who haven't served on the Higher Education Committee before, or simply haven't served in the legislature before. And in fact, I'm leaving this room and making an appointment with one of them who I've heard has expressed an interest to talk to me, pending what this committee does as I get through today. But I think the presentation is, first of all, this is what the university is doing. We present, and maybe many of you have seen it, we have an accountability report that's about this thick. It's a very good document. I would see if I could make, you know, I'm sure it's available online, get that information for them. Say practically anything you want to know about the university is in this report. But I'm here for to answer any questions you may have about it. I'll probably, you know, go over some of our bragging points, the number of graduates, the number of applications we had, how over the last several years our graduation rates have improved, how over the last several years the incoming class of freshmen have improved in terms of their preparation to succeed in college. I'll talk about the research that we are doing and how important it is to the state. I'll talk about the extension services and the public services we provide around the state. And I would open myself up for questions they have about any of that. You can't do it all in a 15-minute appointment, but I would certainly want to plant some seeds that would encourage them to go find out more on their own and make myself available to answer what's most pressing on their minds.
All right, Lois Josephson. Talked about right sizing and share just a little bit about the previous interview. The person in your chair shared personal experience in working with some students on campus where one of them happened to make the statement they're getting ready to get their degree this year and they've never had a class from a full professor. As the board looks at the challenges that it will be facing, and you very nicely outlined them, how might you bring that issue into the discussion?
I'm kind of surprised to hear that, quite frankly. I knew that was a problem several years ago, and I've known that, you know, there's been effort to correct that. One of the things that will happen as the university downsizes is we will have to keep a focus on the ratio of full-time tenured faculty to the other faculty, adjunct faculty or part-time instructors. It's easier to reduce the workforce on the adjuncts and the part-times. It's more expensive to have the tenured, but one thing that could happen is that, you know, we could be losing adjuncts and instructors as colleges find that's the easiest place to make a quick cut in the budget. Yes, some classes will get larger, but it's more likely those classes will be taught by a professor. But I think that discussion also needs to happen in the Board of Regents and through the Educational Planning and Policy Committee. What do we do about that? We used to have problems at the university, and this predates my service on the board, where one of the obstacles to people graduating in 4 years was they just simply couldn't get this particular class they needed in that 4 years. And the university's response to it was to say, well, we're going to guarantee that you will. Now it's going to be a challenge to maintain that as we cut back, you know, we're not going to cut, for example, Econ 1. It probably has a longer number than that now. That's what it was when I went took it. But, you know, when I took it, there were maybe 50 sections of it. And there, I don't know how many sections there are now, but there won't be as many sections of it. So to guarantee that to a student might be, you know, it's going to be problematic how we reduce the number of offerings and still ensure that students can get the coursework they need within 4 years. But certainly part of that discussion has to be, you have to have some, maybe you don't have to, I think you should have some associations with full professors sometime during your course. I know, as you were talking about the question, I was thinking back when I was a student, I saw some on screens when I was a freshman. I don't think I had any, and I probably had some courses that were taught by full professors, but they were very large professors my first couple years. It wasn't until I was a junior and a senior, and theater being a small department is probably why I got a lot of association with full professors by the time I graduated. But it's upsetting to me to hear that now. I had not heard that recently. But it's good for me to know that that's still a concern.
I'm sorry. I hate to interrupt you, but we appreciate your long and thoughtful answer, but we've got two questions.
I'll try to be brief. I'm sorry.
We're just about out of time. No, George?
I had two of them. Let me go to another one. Excuse me, Madam Chair, Regent Hunter. With your background, have you had any issues with tenure at your position there?
Dealing with faculty tenure?
Yes.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the faculty... through their committee process, revised the tenure code and passed it on to us, and we approved the changes to the tenure code. We have not had any what I would call contentious issues that have come before the board. That's the short answer. I can give a longer answer.
That's fine.
Paul, I appreciate your patience, but I've tried to get everybody to get their first question.
I'm pleased to know that at least a president-elect Kaler knows what the relative costs are between Stony Brook and University of Support, that he does at least. I'm sorry you all know. This is a yes or no. Has anybody studied the relationship between tuition increases and the impact that may have on graduation rates per se? And that's just yes or no. And then when you speak about right sizing and so on, and all the important issues that you interestingly addressed in regard to the challenges ahead, dealing with the fiscal challenges that we have. And as I reflected on testimony or on the Regent Kennedy yesterday, who was talking about the problems we had with the Chamber of Commerce. On the one hand, everybody says the University of Minnesota is the most important agent for the engine of growth and so on that we have. And then he explained why it was that we don't have any support out of the Chamber of Commerce, and it's because the rest of the budget isn't explained to them, and so they can't support the university, which seems strange to me. But it also suggests to me that in the business community, Chamber of Commerce business partnership, however described, that there, if you set aside the special things at the university like research and education, which don't lend itself to comparison to other institutions to business and so on, but if you take management, for instance, which does, and you say how many layers do we have and how many, what's best practice and so on, and you start introducing some of those concepts, if the board does that intentionally in order to get the attention of the business community and for the business community to say these guys are doing it the right way, it might be that you could engender a lot more support than you have as you proceed with right sizing and so on.
Thank you. Was there a question there?
There was a question in the first part.
There are two questions. Would does that make any sense? Does it make any sense? Do you think it could be done? And the first one is just yes or no.
To the second part of your question, yes, I think that's an excellent idea. And you know, I think that the president might do well to consult, actually, with some business people about those kind of systems. So the first part, I know you want yes or no. I can say I don't know. I do know that we've tried to emphasize that if you want to save $20,000, graduate in 4 years over 5 years. The counter-argument to that is, but if I can only go to school part-time because of the cost of tuition, it's going to take longer. We've tried to address some of that in tuition banding. It doesn't cost you any more to take 18 credits and 13, so why don't you take the 18? It's a better deal. So I don't know if a direct relationship has been tied to grad rates.
All right. Just did that up a very brief closing statement, Stephen
Hunter. I'll be as brief as I can, and we've discussed a lot of serious issues, so maybe I'll just say something lightheartedly. One of the things that happens in life is you find out that what you seek isn't seen by the public necessarily as always such a big deal. I was, shortly after I was elected to the Board of Regents, I went to buy a new car. I'm going to get one of those license plates that have like U of M Minnesota on it. $35 goes to the university. Well, the car salesman said, well, you have to establish some kind of connection to the university, which I thought was odd. If somebody wants to send me $35, that's okay. But what do you do? And so I said, well, I'm on the Board of Regents, and I gave him one of my cards. He kind of looked puzzled. He says, what's that? And I said, well, we're 12 people, and we govern the university. He goes, he looked very skeptical, and I was in a hurry. I said, well, how about this? And I had a life membership card for the Alumni Association. Oh, okay. The conclusion is perhaps I should be more proud of my life membership in the Alumni Association, the fact that I've served 6 years on the board. I am very proud I've served on the board, and I would love your support.
You are really
good job, Marilyn.
Good job, Marilyn.
Yeah,